It appears Israel has retaliated against Iran. The U.S. blocks U.N. membership for the Palestinians.
12 votes in favor, 1 vote against, 2 abstentions.
With a vote scheduled for USA to Ukraine, a warning. Without the money, Ukraine may lose the war.
CIA Director William Burns calls the situation dire and says Ukraine's fate may well hinge on what U.S. lawmakers do next.
And a giant snake in India and a giant sea creature in Britain.
The Ichthyotitan severnensis was between 72 and 85 feet long.
Today is Friday, April 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. There are reports coming out of Iran being reported by ABC News and CNN that Israeli missiles have hit Iran. A U.S. official says days after Iran launched a drone strike on Israel in response to an attack at the Iranian embassy in Syria, Iran's Fars news agency said an explosion was heard at an airport in the Iranian city Isfahan. As we're going on the air with this program, the cause is not immediately known. Several Iranian nuclear sites are located in that province, including Natanz, the centerpiece of Iran's uranium enrichment program. Iran told the United Nations Security Council on Thursday that Israel must be compelled to stop any further military adventurism. The UN Secretary General warned that the Middle East was in a moment of maximum peril. You can get more information online at voanews.com and from our hourly newscasts on the VOA radio network. Full membership for the Palestinian Authority at the United Nations has been blocked by the United States.
The result of the vote is as follows. 12 votes in favor, 1 vote against, 2 abstentions.
The no vote by the U.S. stops the United Nations from recognizing a Palestinian state. The United States says an independent Palestinian state should be established through direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and not through UN action.
The United States continues to strongly support a two-state solution. This vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood, but instead is an acknowledgement that it will only come from direct negotiations between the parties.
U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Robert Wood. The U.S. vetoed a draft resolution that recommended to the 193-member U.N. General Assembly that the state of Palestine be admitted to membership of the United Nations. Britain and Switzerland abstained, while the remaining 12 council members voted yes. Riyad Mansour is the permanent observer to the United Nations for Palestine.
We've been waiting since 1947, and we are in 2024. Admit us to membership. It's an investment in peace.
This is the second Palestinian attempt for full membership, and it comes as the war in Gaza has put the more than 75-year-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict at center stage. Now, the two-state solution is something we've talked about before. It's something we've heard many times since the latest conflict began on October 7th with the Hamas attack on Israel. I recently talked to Lori Brand, a professor at the University of Southern California, about the two-state solution. Is that anywhere on the horizon?
I don't think so. I mean, the U.S. administration had stopped talking about it. I mean, it hadn't really been interested in this for some time. And I think there was a lot of lip service given to it to the extent that Palestinian issues were considered at all. And it's been revived because it seems like among a set of extremely difficult possibilities, it perhaps seems like the least difficult. But I think, given the situation on the ground, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, also given the situation in Israel politically, given that the United States is in an election year, given the position that some major European states have taken in this war, I just don't. I don't see it. I don't. It's not just a matter of kind of political will from the outside, but it's also what are we looking at? The kind of changes that have taken place on the ground in the areas that were at least initially thought of as being the basis of the Palestinian part of the two-state solution, which is the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And unfortunately, what we've seen since the Oslo Accords is the gradual, sort of inexorable expropriation, continuing expropriation of land, continuing expansion of settlements, new settlements built, such that, you know, there is the actual physical basis for a Palestinian state, something which there would be contiguous territory, which doesn't look like a piece of Swiss cheese, which is the way people used to refer to it. But I mean, even now, it would have too many holes to even hold together as a piece of Swiss cheese.
Lori Brand from the University of Southern California. Palestinians inspected a large crater and damage caused to an area following an Israeli airstrike in Rafah overnight. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 15 people were killed in the strike, including children. A relative of the people killed said they had been displaced from other parts of the Gaza Strip. Sanctions on Venezuela, as the Biden administration said it would not renew a license that had largely eased oil sanctions. Reuters correspondent Julian Satterthwaite reports it's in response to President Nicolas Maduro's failure to deliver on election promises.
Hours before the deadline, the U.S. Treasury Department issued a new license, giving firms 45 days to wind down oil and gas operations in the country. It all comes after Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro failed to honor all terms in the deal that had eased sanctions. The U.S. says he's breached a promise to allow the opposition to run a candidate of its choice in July's presidential election. However, the news of renewed sanctions drew a defiant response from the Venezuelan leader.
When did we become a gringo colony, a star of the United States? When? Can someone tell me? Venezuela is a country that walks on its own feet, uses its own head, produces with its own hands.
Government supporters insist Venezuela has honored the deal with the U.S., but Washington says Maduro has harassed, intimidated, or detained opponents. Multiple opposition allies and activists have faced arrest in recent months. Opposition leader Maria Corina Machado condemned the government's actions.
The regime violated every agreement. They haven't complied with everything they promised. Instead, they've intensified repression. They've incarcerated more people. They've persecuted. They've barred opposition members. Everything they said they wouldn't do.
Global oil prices rose following news of the new sanctions. International benchmark Brent crude gained around 0.25% early Thursday. Prices had already faced upward pressure amid concern conflict in the Middle East could affect supplies.
Reuters correspondent Julian Satterthwaite. We're following these other stories from around the world. The bodies of the 10 Kenyan military services men killed in a helicopter crash on Thursday were returned to Nairobi for a religious service.
Listen to the prayers for the souls of thy servant, whom you have called to yourself.
Two soldiers survived the crash. An investigation is underway. Indians have lined up to cast their votes in phase one of a seven-stage election to elect a new parliament. It'll be the world's largest election. Nearly 1 billion people are eligible to cast ballots. Surveys are suggesting a comfortable win for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party. A jury of 12 people was seated Thursday in former President Donald Trump's history-making hush money trial, propelling the proceedings closer to opening statements and the start of weeks of testimony. Right-wing politicians, academics, and campaigners from across Europe gathered in Brussels this week for a two-day national conservatism conference that organizers say is aimed at preserving the nation-state in Europe. As Henry Ridgewell reports, an effort by the Brussels mayor to shut down the conference prompted accusations of an assault on the right to free speech.
The foremost figures in European right-wing politics gathered for the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels this week. Among them, Nigel Farage, the architect of Britain's exit from the European Union, and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. In their sights were the familiar foes, the European Union and immigration. Orbán spoke at the conference Wednesday.
If somebody would like to make an attempt to create a mixed society, Christian-based with Muslim communities, and as liberals think, the outcome will be something good, let's do it. It's your fate, it's your future, but don't force us to do so.
Orbán criticized Western support for Ukraine in its fight against Russian invaders.
Without getting the money and the weapons from the European Union and United States, Ukraine as a state would cease to exist. But it's not a sovereign state anymore.
Orbán has become the figurehead of the European right, analyst Georgios Samaras says.
Because he's highly successful in pushing an authoritarian practice, an authoritarian regime in his own country. I believe that the far right now is trying to use the same playbook.
The conference billed itself as a meeting of like-minded conservatives to preserve the nation-state in Europe ahead of European Parliament elections scheduled in June. But the meeting nearly didn't go ahead. Police blocked access to the venue Tuesday after the mayor of Brussels issued an order to shut down the conference, citing public security concerns. An emergency court ruling overturned the mayor's order. Participants said his actions were an example of what they labelled left-wing cancel culture. Polls suggest centre-right and far-right parties are set to gain seats at the June European elections. A recent EU survey suggests that Russia's invasion of Ukraine and European defence and security are high on the list of voter priorities. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Foreign ministers from the Group of Seven Nations are discussing tensions in the Middle East during their meeting in Capri, Italy. The agenda is topped by calls for targeting new sanctions against Iran over its attack against Israel and more aid to Ukraine to fight Russia's war.
If Putin is allowed to proceed with impunity, we know he won't stop at Ukraine, and we can safely predict that his aggression will continue. Other would-be aggressors around the world will take note and unleash their own aggressions, and we will have a world of conflict, not a world of peace and security.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The vote on U.S. aid for Ukraine has been scheduled for Saturday. As lawmakers in Congress edge closer to the vote for $61 billion for Ukraine, a top U.S. intelligence official warned that help cannot come soon enough. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports.
CIA Director William Burns calls the situation dire and says Ukraine's fate may well hinge on what U.S. lawmakers do next.
There is a very real risk that the Ukrainians could lose on the battlefield by the end of 2024.
Speaking to an audience in Dallas, Burns described the U.S. supplemental assistance package as more than a lifeline for Kyiv in its war against Russia and Russian President Vladimir Putin. If Congress passes it soon.
Ukrainians are entirely capable of holding their own through 2024 and puncturing Putin's arrogant view that time is on his side.
The CIA director says the U.S. aid will allow Ukraine to strike deeper into Crimea and do more damage to Russia's Black Sea Fleet, where Ukrainian forces have sunk 16 Russian warships in just the last 6 months. Meanwhile, at the Pentagon, officials say they're confident they can get Ukraine the aid it needs if lawmakers approve the $61 billion package.
We have a very robust logistics network that enables us to move materiel very quickly.
Pentagon Press Secretary Major General Pat Ryder.
The Ukrainians have demonstrated their resilience and their courage under fire. We have no reason to think that that's going to change, but we also understand the dire situation there right now, which is why, again, we would like very much to see the supplemental passed.
Should U.S. lawmakers approve the additional assistance for Ukraine, the Pentagon says the first deliveries could include air defense and artillery capabilities. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, U.S. President Joe Biden wants to triple tariffs on some steel imports from China because he says they are unfairly undermining U.S. jobs. It's an appeal to American workers in a state that is central to the presidential campaign. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Hello, Pittsburgh!
President Biden told Pennsylvania steelworkers that he'll protect their jobs from cheap Chinese imports.
And the prices are unfairly low because China's steel companies don't need to worry about making a profit because the Chinese government is subsidizing them so heavily. They're not competing. They're cheating. They're cheating. And we've seen the damage here in America.
Biden promised to stand up to unfair Chinese competition, calling Beijing xenophobic. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Xian says accusations of xenophobia are hypocritical, coming from a country that he says should lift its protectionist measures against China. Xian says China is aware of the reports and asks, are you talking about China or the U.S. itself? Biden acting against Chinese steel would come on top of tariffs imposed by his predecessor, Donald Trump, who put a 25% tax on some Chinese steel. The Trump presidential campaign said in a statement to VOA, quote, the Biden campaign is attacking President Trump's effective tariffs on China, while the Biden White House is planning to implement similar tariffs. The Trump campaign added, Biden's team is either run by hypocrites or people who don't know what they're doing. One difference in the candidate's approach is that Trump used tariffs more broadly to impact new trade deals, says Rachel Ziemba from the Center for a New American Security.
They were using tariffs partly as leverage for sort of resetting the trade side of things. Now, the Biden administration, they're using tariffs, they're trying to target them, but they're also using industrial policy and other incentives to try to encourage U.S. production, to encourage foreign and American companies to invest in the United States.
Pennsylvania steelworkers are an important vote in a state that could help swing this election for either candidate. The Biden campaign's out with this commercial featuring Pennsylvania steelworker JoJo Burgess.
Right now, we have the most pro-American worker president in office that we've ever had in this country's history. Donald Trump cares about one person and one person only, and that's Donald Trump.
Trump campaigned for union votes during last year's auto strike by telling workers that Biden administration regulations are an attack on their jobs.
The auto industry is being assassinated, and it makes no difference what you get. I don't care what you get in the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 5 weeks. They're going to be closing up, and they're going to be building those cars in China and other places.
NBC News polling earlier this year found that union household voters favor Biden over Trump, but by a smaller margin than in their 2020 contest. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
China and Indonesia have pledged to maintain regional peace and stability and agree that a UN Security Council resolution on a ceasefire in Gaza must be fully implemented, according to China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, on Thursday. He's saying we will continue to lead the Belt and Road international cooperation to expand digital, economic, and other emerging markets and work together to promote sustainable development and economic transformation. And finally, two giant creatures that once roamed the earth. The first found in India, a snake, says Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani, that appears to have been longer than a school bus.
Researchers in India say fossils found in western Gujarat state reveal an ancient snake that stretched an estimated 36 to 50 feet. That's comparable to the biggest known snake that once lived in what's now Colombia at about 42 feet long. The newly discovered remains date to 47 million years ago. The snake could have weighed more than a ton, up to 2,200 pounds. The longest living snake today is Asia's reticulated python at 33 feet. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And in England, another giant creature, this one never before seen, a whole new species. Here's Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn with this story.
Oh, that's just an exceptional find.
This jawbone fossil found by a British father-daughter duo belonged to perhaps the largest known marine reptile on Earth, dating back to around 202 million years ago. Ruby and Justin Reynolds found the bone in May 2020 on a beach in Somerset, England. They contacted paleontologist Dean Lomax, who said 4 years before their discovery, fossil hunter Paul de la Salle found a similar bone just down the coast.
We described Paul's bone in 2018 in a study as an unusual giant jawbone, part of a serrangula from right at the back of the jaw of an ichthyosaur.
Researchers said on Wednesday the Reynolds bone is also from an ichthyosaur. The discovery of a second jawbone confirms the existence of a new species not previously known.
Based on that unique shape, various different structures, the fact that they're both right from the end of the Triassic period, about 202 million years ago, supports our identification of something entirely new to science.
The Ichthyotitan severnensis was between 72 and 85 feet long. That means it would rival the largest animal to ever exist, the blue whale, which can reach up to 100 feet long.
No other marine reptiles got as large as these animals did.
The giant marine reptile lived 13 million years later than any others known to date. Researchers believe they could have survived until a global mass extinction event about 201 million years ago.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A little over 70 years ago, the Korean Armistice Agreement was signed, setting North and South Korea down two vastly different paths, observed U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, on a recent visit to the demilitarized zone dividing North and South Korea. It is a world in which, just miles to the south, we see democracy and prosperity. Just miles to the north, repression and isolation. A world in which true peace and coexistence remain beyond reach, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. That is without question due to the DPRK's escalatory rhetoric, misguided decision-making, destabilizing actions, actions that endanger the peace and security of the region and beyond it. The United States harbors no hostile intent toward the DPRK, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. We have repeatedly asked Pyongyang to reject provocation and embrace dialogue. We have held the doors open for meaningful diplomacy, and we remain open to dialogue, because our goal, ultimately, is to achieve a peaceful and stable peninsula, a peaceful and stable world. The United States is grateful to the 28,500 soldiers standing shoulder to shoulder with troops from the Republic of Korea and multilateral forces in service to that goal, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. President Biden has said that America will lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. That commitment is what separates us and partners like the Republic of Korea from those that oppose their people, reject multilateralism, and endanger international peace and security, who measure their might by their munitions and try to proliferate their way into power, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. And so, as we link arms with allies in the fight for nonproliferation, human rights, and democracy, we also reaffirm that the only way to achieve these ends is through diplomacy. With the Republic of Korea and Japan now by its side, the United States will continue to work in the UN Security Council to hold responsible those threatening the nonproliferation regime. That includes Russia and China, as both countries continue to use their positions in the Security Council to shield the DPRK from accountability. We urge Russia and China to reverse course, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, and once again to urge Pyongyang to choose diplomacy and come to the negotiating table, to ensure the next 7 decades are more peaceful than the last.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.